Associates. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, featuring performances by the gifted jazz saxophonist Joshua Redman and his quartet, and the reggae-funk Afro-Cuban mix of the Chicago-based band Funkadaisy. Visit KrannertCenter.com for more information.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. In the first hour of the program today, we will talk about how it is we talk about, think about, have tried to prepare for a terrorist attack against the United States. And we'll be asking some very large questions, those being, are we prepared to deal with the attack in an appropriate way that would provide for the continued functioning of government and also the protection of civil liberties for Americans? And our guest of the program is Bruce Ackerman. He is Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale, and he has authored or co-authored more than 15 books dealing with political philosophy, constitutional law, and public policy. And he's the author of a newly published book that looks at those questions that I have mentioned. The book is Before the Next Attack, and the subtitle is Preserving Civil Liberties in an Age of Terrorism. It's published by the Yale University Press. I'm sure you could find it in the bookstore if you would like to read it. As we talk here, as always, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we could keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But anyone's welcome to call and engage in conversation here with the guest. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, and you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or in fact anywhere in the United States, if you'd happen to be listening to us on the internet, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. So at any point here, people have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. Professor Ackerman, hello.
How are you, David?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
Yes, pretty well.
Actually. Good. Very good. Let me ask you, again, a sort of a large question to start with, one that you deal with immediately in the book, and a question that I think people raised virtually from the day after September 11th and still are talking about that. And that is, what's the appropriate kind of language to use to talk about the threat posed by terrorist groups, non-state groups like al-Qaeda, the threat they pose to the United States? And right from the beginning, we have used, government has used, the media has used the term war. And almost right from the beginning, some people have said, wait a minute, that's not really quite right. And in fact, the title of your very first chapter is, This is Not a War. What is the problem, do you think, with using that kind of language to talk about this particular kind of threat?
Well, you know, this is the fundamental question. I want to build on the idea of the state of emergency. But first, let me try to explain why this is not a war. First, we declare war against named countries like Germany. We didn't declare war on a technique. Terrorism is the name of a technique. So if we declare war, we didn't say we declare war on rockets in the Second World War. We declared war on Germany. If we declare war on a technique, then when the next attack occurs, we don't have a well-defined group of people to concentrate our attention on, and that authorizes the president to pick up people who look suspicious. So that's the first basic problem with war talk. The second basic problem, an even more fundamental one really, is that the problem of terrorism has to do with the free market, not great concentrations of armed force. If the Middle East were transformed into a paradise of a democracy, there would still be, out of 6 billion people in the world, tens of millions of crazy people. And what's going on here is really something very new and fundamental, but not a war. The state is losing its monopoly over weapons of mass destruction. Crazy people used to kill, assassinate leaders, or maybe blow up a building. But in the next 50 years, they will have suitcase bombs and things of this kind and wreak massive destruction. Unfortunately, as the technologies improve and as the state loses control over it, because there are so many places in the world that are producing these weapons, they'll go to the highest bidder. And if we eliminated the problem of the Middle East, well, then the next group might be from Montana. Or, the federal office building in Oklahoma City was destroyed not by Al-Qaeda. So we have a serious and ongoing problem. Prevention is terribly important. And, of course, we've been focused on that. But we should expect from time to time a disaster. And if we call it a war, that will authorize the war powers of the president to select out suspicious people for an endless period of time. This is a terrible threat to our future as Americans. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm proposing. But there's a real problem. If a group is well-organized enough to strike once, maybe it is also well-organized and has a second strike already planned. So we should, in the aftermath of a terrorist attack, authorize the president to have well-defined emergency powers, but not the way we do it now under the war power and give them a carte blanche forever, but every 2 months we should require the president, this is my idea of the emergency constitution, which is the central feature of this book, we should require the president to come back to Congress and get explicit authorization for a two-month period. And every time he comes back, we should make it harder for him. The first time, he should get 50% votes out of both houses of Congress. The second time, the second 2 months, we should have 60% votes, and then 70% votes. And then for every succeeding two-month period of emergency, 80%. You see, because the third feature that's bad about war, when we fought and won or even lost wars in the past, everybody knew it. This war, precisely because it isn't against the sovereign state, but a set of amorphous people buying weapons of mass destruction on the free market, is never going to end. So we need a mechanism which will return us to normality if, after the first attack, a second one doesn't occur. Mm-hmm. So that's the key thought of this book, that we have to revamp our separation of powers. I'm trying to continue the founding tradition of having checks and balances under this idea of a temporary state of emergency, and of course presidents and governors are always declaring states of emergency, Katrina being an obvious example, have checks and balances for a genuine state of emergency after an attack, but let's not call it war, which destroys our tradition of checks and balances and brings out the unilateral power of the president to conduct endless military operations.
Hmm. Let me raise another point there, the one that is it would be worthy of at least another book and another conversation. But that is that the Constitution, as you point out in the book, the Constitution gives Congress the power to declare war. But one of the things we know is that it's been a long time since Congress declared war. And the concern that a lot of people have raised, and it's not a new concern, not simply about this administration, is that the presidency has gathered to itself much too much power to exercise military force, and the Congress has abrogated its responsibility that is given by the Constitution to declare war, so that in that respect, the balance between the two powers is off balance. It's tipped completely over to one side.
Right.
Assuming that you would agree with that, how do we address that? What should we do about
that? Well, I do think that this book is a partial answer to this, and I want to emphasize that this book is not about President Bush. This book is about, or even the war in Iraq. You and I can have our own opinions about it. I am talking about something that's going to happen from time to time for the next 100 years. And that's why we need constitutional thought of the kind that you're suggesting here, to, you know, save our republic from every time the next attack occurs. The president gets on television and says, we have to declare war this time. We're going to round up 10,000 people and declare them enemy combatants, that kind of stuff. The point that you're making is relevant to this book, because if we keep on repeating, if all politicians, which they all are, Democrats and Republicans alike, saying we're having a war on terror, then when the president, a future president, decides that some new rogue state is the central front on the war on terrorism, it's much easier constitutionally for him to unilaterally invade, because everybody knows that while Congress has the power to declare war, the president has the right to define where the battles are. So if there's an ongoing war on terrorism and Iraq is just a battle in this ongoing war, the president has already won a great deal of the battle for his power to invade a country. If, however, we recognize that the problem of terrorism is a problem of fringe groups getting more and more dangerous weapons on the black market, and then most of them being stopped by the security services, but once in a while striking. We call that a state of emergency when it happens. Then there'll be a different conversation about whether we should declare war. You're quite right. The Supreme Court has abandoned this conversation. But in fact, whatever else you want to say about it, the president did gain congressional assent. They didn't call it war, but they did give explicit congressional assent to the invasion of Afghanistan, and also, kicking and screaming, they gave assent to the invasion of Iraq. So it's terribly important to separate out two different conversations. When the terrorists attack, what are we going to do to stop a second attack? Because it could be from Montana the next time. Or we don't know where it's from. But we should try to stop it. And this is an emergency. And the president should have limited powers, but special ones. We could have to talk about what they might be. And then we'll have another conversation. Should we declare war on some rogue state? Then we'll have the normal pushing and shoving between the president, who says, I can do it by myself, and then Congress says, I can't. It would be much better if the Supreme Court intervened, but I don't have very high hopes, actually, in the middle term for that to happen.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour, Bruce Ackerman. He's professor of law and political science at Yale and author of a number of books, including a new one titled Before the Next Attack, Preserving Civil Liberties in an Age of Terrorism. The Yale University Press is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. But let me ask you again, this is
sure.
Another big question, but there has now...
I'm really grateful for you to ask the fundamental questions, because my point in this book is not so much to give answers, although of course I try, but to direct people's attention to the fact that we're in a period of relative calm, mm-hmm. and that we should be thinking seriously about this problem and designing a framework that will be sensible. Because I don't want to say that terrorism isn't a problem. That's a ridiculous thought. And I don't want to say that we should rely on the courts alone to protect us. Mm-hmm. We should talk sometime about this week, and the Supreme Court made a very important decision or non-decision in the Padilla case, but I'll leave it to you to raise that question.
All right, well, we'll do that. Well, let me ask this. Now, for a couple of months, there has been some dialogue, debate, conversation, argument, whatever word you want to use, going back and forth between the president and Congress that right. goes back to last year when it was reported that the president had authorized the National Security Agency to conduct surveillance on calls and emails when at least one of the parties was outside of the United States, and it was thought that possibly there could be some connection to al-Qaeda. Right. And the administration apparently is making the argument that Congress granted the president blanket power to deal with terrorism after September 11th. The administration says, you know, this was the proverbial blank check. They said to Congress, you said to the president, go and get them. And the administration seemed to assume that meant that they could do anything. And they make this argument based on past presidents and past wars, this argument that Congress grants these blanket powers to the president in wartime. Now, some of the members of Congress have returned, that's not what we meant. So now I guess the question is it possible to give an administration the kind of flexibility required to deal with this unusual, shifting, hard-to-pin-down threat, and at the same time have appropriate congressional oversight of right. what the administration does?
Right. You see, this is just the separation between the invasion of another country and its domestic implications that I want to – I think that this emergency constitution that I'm talking about will respond to. You see, because the administration's argument is that the authorization for the use of force in Afghanistan, that's what everybody thought they were voting on 3 days after September 11th, also grants the authority to conduct domestic operations. You see? Now, if we had an emergency constitution, there would be two votes. Should we invade Afghanistan or not? Should we grant the president emergency powers at home? Maybe extraordinary powers should include, for a limited time, surveillance of conversations under much weaker evidentiary standards than usual. But after 60 days, they have to be approved again by 60% of the Congress. They don't have to, you know, meanwhile, we're fighting in Afghanistan, you see. These are two different issues. When we should invade another country, and when and how much Americans should be called to sacrifice their rights that are protected by the Constitution in normal times. And the unfortunate mixture of these two things is what I'm trying to get people to think about. There could be no doubt that if we had had an emergency constitution in place, emergency powers domestically of the president would have lapsed, you know, after 6 or 8 or 10 months. And notice the president's still doing it 4 years later. The standard civil liberties response is he should never ever have the right to do it. The other extreme is this is a war, and it's an endless war, and the president can, you know, exercise his commander-in-chief powers anywhere he wants to be effective. And what I want to say is there is a definite problem when one of these fringe groups does something terrible, and mind you, they will. Sometimes, and it'll be much more terrible than September 11th. 10,000 people could die or something of this kind. So this is serious, and it'd be perfectly plausible to say, well, let's really press down in the next few months and try to round up people, and investigate intensively and prevent this next attack if it's going to come. Of course, we don't know. Maybe there was a really fringe group. They were just, quote-unquote, lucky. But this is a whole different discussion of whether it's wise to invade a rogue state. And if we do invade a rogue state, it could take us years to get out of that. And that and the fate of our progress in some rogue in some foreign country should have nothing to do with when we can get back to the normal exercise of liberties at home.
Well, let's
talk.
That's
what I'm trying to accomplish.
Let us talk with a listener, someone in Indiana, on our toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello. This is one of those problems that I guess, you know, gets me all rinsed up, and I don't have any influence whatsoever. I'm usually consider myself extremely progressive, but I do understand certain parts about you need to sense canvas things quickly and effectively, and that's probably where I would go at this administration, the effectively thing. Plus, I just don't trust these guys. There might be some groups I would want to give those kinds of powers to, but I don't. These guys would use it for a lot of other things than just, you know, protecting the American homeland. The question, I've listened to a lot of commentators and stuff, but and since you know about the law, I was wondering what kind of statement can be found in the past that would either lend credence to or not for the usual argument you hear the administration give is that everything has happened so quickly in this electronic age, we can't mess around running down a judge someplace, you know. You know, we're just not going to go searching malls and stuff like that. We're just going to do it. And, you know, that fits into so much of American icon, the Westerns, all that stuff. You know, it's it just sort of falls on everybody, and everybody sort of goes, well, yeah, I think, well, maybe so. I don't know about that. I was wondering what you could say about
sure.
that. Thanks.
Sure. There are 2 points here. By the time if my proposals are taken seriously, and I don't know about that, and if some serious people actually led Congress to enact such a statute, which might happen in the next Congress, you know, it's not impossible. What we would be doing, we're not talking about the Bush administration. They'll be out of power by the time this thing gets off the ground, if it ever does. And when we look over the next 100 years, let's imagine we'll be lucky and only 4 or 5 terrorist attacks of major proportion occur at different intervals. We have to think that way, you know, and sometimes the administrations are going to be pretty good, sometimes pretty bad, sometimes terrible. If they're really terrible, nothing we do is going to control them. But most of these administrations will be not terrible, not great. And that's how we should think about this. What kind of powers we give these people in the short term? We have to avoid these panic reactions, you see. I mean, the Patriot Act will be followed by something much worse than the Patriot Act the next time around, unless we have this framework for saying, well, you can do some things for a short period of time. So that's the basic thought. We're looking to the future. Now, as to the this NSA controversy, which, of course, is important, I want to distinguish between 2 points. 1 point, which is really terrible, and that is that the president exercised this power in secret. This is unacceptable. Whatever you think, even if you thought that the president did have the constitutional authority to order in violation of the statute this kind of eavesdropping, then he especially has to tell the American people that he's doing it. This idea that he can't tell the American people because, quote-unquote, the terrorists will find out, well, we want that's just a silly claim. He doesn't have to tell the American people the details of what he's doing, but he has to tell the American people, or he should tell the American people, that he is, in his judgment, justifiably, violating the statute, which, it should be said, permits 15-day warrantless searches only in the case of an explicit declaration of war. That's what the statute actually says. And if he's violating it, at the very least, he should say so publicly. Now, and of course, what my emergency constitution does is make this package of powers, however we define them, a public and subject to public debate, public scrutiny, and regular votes. So the really bad thing about this, and it's a precedent for the next attack, you see, everything that we let happen this time will get much worse the next time, is this idea that the president could violate the law in secret. Now, then there is the second question, my own, you know, which legal scholars disagree about. But my belief is that the president does not have the constitutional authority to violate FISA, and that the best reading of the statute, the authorization of the use of force, right after September 11th, does not authorize the president to engage in this. But this is, you know, more of a debate on both sides, and of course, I think I'm right, and then other people think they're right. But on this question of secrecy, which somehow, you know, I mean, the attorney general said, well, we weren't going to say it publicly because maybe Congress wouldn't authorize it. Well, that's just shocking. Of course you should say it to the American people, and so that they know what you're doing. Public opinion is the final check on the use of arbitrary power. If you just have secret violations of the law, that's going to the very core of the American constitutional tradition. Hmm.
Just quickly, let me ask this question, because you're talking about how it is we think about the powers we grant to the president, and whether indeed we should venture into doing something that's permanent and later we might decide wasn't the right thing, or make them more temporary and make sure that there is congressional oversight and there's review. You also talk in the book, present the nightmare scenario of what would happen if there was a terrorist attack against Washington, D.C., and would damage, say, the president is killed, say, the vice president is killed, say, members of Congress are killed, and it would make it very difficult for government to function. In that case, you also make some recommendations about perhaps thinking differently, for example, about the succession of power that we have, and about, you know, how many members of Congress do you actually have to have for it to be able to function? And how dealing with the fact that then new members would have to be provided to Washington, and all this could take a lot of time. To do all of this, would we have to amend the Constitution, which is, as people probably know, a difficult and intentionally difficult sort of thing? What would it take to make the changes that you're talking about?
Gee, David, thank you very much for raising that, because, of course, there is the normal terrorist incident, terrible as it is, but there is some chance of an assault on Washington itself, and we are, legally speaking, utterly unprepared for this. The Constitution, let's start with the presidency, because that's not unimportant. The Constitution grants the power explicitly to Congress to if the president and the vice president are both dead or incapacitated, to pass a statute, and a statute exists. It was passed by Harry under the Truman administration, and it is not well designed for our present problems. What it says is, I'll give you a little scenario to dramatize it. Day one, there's a small suitcase bomb on Pennsylvania Avenue, and this, the horrible things that you were saying happen. The person who seems to be the next in line is the Secretary of Defense, because he's across the river, you know, in the Pentagon. So he takes power as acting president under the existing statute. And then his first act is to appoint by himself in a rush 9 members of the Supreme Court who hold office until the end of the congressional term. as an interim appointment without anybody's advice and consent. Then, on day two, it develops that the president pro tem of the Senate, which is a very titular office, no power, 86-year-old person is often in this titular position, he is named as a person in the statute who can bump the Secretary of Defense out of his job and become acting president of the United States. So let's imagine that the year is 2009 and the Democrats had won the presidency, but they didn't win the Senate, so the Republicans are in charge. So this 86-year-old Republican fella becomes the acting president as of right under existing law. Now, as you were pointing out, David, let's imagine there are 50 people left on the House of Representatives. Under the existing rules of the House, get together and say that they are the House of Representatives, 50 people, and they select, and let's imagine that the majority who survive are Democrats, and they select a new Speaker of the House. Under the statute, the Truman statute, the new Speaker of the House can bump the President of the Senate. So there's a Democrat there. The only problem is that under the explicit Constitution, the Constitution explicitly says 218 members, a majority of the House, has to be there to conduct business. So the question is whether 50 is really a House of Representatives. So we have a Bush against Gore kind of situation right in the middle of a crisis, of course. And this partisanly selected Supreme Court has to decide whether rules of the House, these rules that permit 50 people to be the House of Representatives, which were enacted by the Republicans in this Congress, are constitutional under the circumstances. Let's say they decide for the Speaker of the House, then there's going to be this moment of constitutional crisis, because maybe the head of the Senate, who's now serving, doesn't agree. Right? Meanwhile, the country is in a state of shock. This is not the way to govern things, and there's no constitutional problem whatsoever about changing this statute, and it should be changed. And the sooner the better. There's just no excuse for this. I have proposals, but my proposals aren't that important, frankly. It's some, but, you know, there are a million more sensible things to do than we have right now. So my proposal is this. In this tragic thing, this is thinking about the unthinkable, but we got to do it. It's like there's a small chance, and the Congress has does things that are a lot less important. They spend a lot of time on it, and they're not spending time on this. So my proposal on the Supreme Court is there are chief judges in each circuit. There are 12 circuits. These judges are 65, and they have to retire their chief judgeship at 70. So we put all their names in a hat, and we select them out at random. We depoliticize the Supreme Court because it'll be called upon to make very important decisions during these crisis conditions. Do we really want a Bush against Gore kind of thing? No. And every, let's say, 2 or 3 years, we create a vacancy by reassigning one of the chief judges back to the circuit that he came from. There's no constitutional problem with this. It's a lot better than having the Secretary of Defense call up all his buddies for 2 hours in the Constitutional Court. And a very important question has to do with this House of Representatives. See, at the present time, it'll be 3 or 4 or 5 months, really, before a new House comes into session if it's elected. That means that for a very substantial period of time, either we settle for this kind of thing that the Republican House just did, and notice, you know, let's imagine the House before the attack was Republican. 50 survivors could be Democrats, or vice versa, you know. I mean, so it's a tremendous shift in power here. that could happen thanks to terrorists. So the question is, you know, how, and if we disregard the House, this, you know, rump House, then we can't pass laws. So this is a serious problem, and do you really want the president just to be issuing decrees? And it isn't the president, mind you, but it might be the Secretary of Agriculture who's issuing these decrees as acting president, wanting to be tough or whatever. So the so my proposal is, and this is a, you know, I'll be interested to hear responses. There has been such a proposal submitted in the House that we create the office of vice representative. You see, the framers created the office of vice president because they could appreciate the bad consequences of a presidential assassination and nobody there already. Well, I say that from now on, this is also, we can do it through a statute. Every district should vote on a ticket. The Republicans should nominate a representative and a vice representative. The vice representative could be a mayor or something like that in the congressional district, something like that. It would be very wise to have them. We won't require it, but it would be wise to have them back at home. And if such a terrible thing occurred, these vice representatives would come to the Capitol. Maybe it'll be in Richmond rather than in Washington, and start functioning. That will permit the same party to be in control before and after. It would not make necessary an election, a special election, under times of crisis. You know, let things cool down maybe for a year or a year and a half before we have another election. It's similar to the pattern that we have established in the Senate. If the Senate is destroyed, then the governors that nominate people till the next election. So it's thinking, you know, you can say what you like about my proposals. I've spent a few years talking to people about them. They're the best I can do. I don't really care whether they're – it's just imperative to have a serious discussion on this. It would be a tragedy if such a thing occurred, and then the crisis would be exacerbated by lawsuits before a mock Supreme Court on who's the president of the United States when maybe there's another attack in California or something going on. So it's really, politicians, and I don't want to say politicians. I mean, it's understandable why congressmen and the president talk all the time about homeland security. You know, that's what we are, beefing up homeland security. This is great. Sometimes there will be failures, and we have to think about that now rather than let such a mess occur afterwards, because there'll be no way out.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. I want to introduce again. Didn't apologize. I think the issue is important. The questions are interesting and well worth thinking about, and it's not the kind of thing you can do in 30 seconds, so don't worry about that. Bruce Ackerman is our guest. He's Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale and has authored many books on political philosophy and constitutional law and public policy. And his newest that deals with this issue here we're talking about is titled Before the Next Attack, Preserving Civil Liberties in an Age of Terrorism, and is published by the Yale University Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. A little earlier, you mentioned the name of Jose Padilla, and maybe we should come back to that case again, because here there's a set of issues that now have again been up for debate virtually since September 11th, and that is the big question here is, what sort of authority does the president have, does the government have, to arrest and hold people who are suspected of terrorism? And clearly the administration felt that it had that power, and not only did it have the power, but it went out and arrested people and believed that they had the power to arrest them, to hold them indefinitely without benefit of counsel, without being charged, without even telling anybody that they had them. And some of them were not citizens, so some people made the argument, well, citizens of the country are non-citizens, not covered by the Constitution. But in the case of someone like Jose Padilla, he is an American citizen. And there the question looms even larger. Well, you know, what good is the Constitution? And it doesn't – it certainly should apply to him. We have set a dangerous precedent here if we say that you can take anybody – lock them up for as long as you want, not charging, not providing them with attorney, not even telling anybody that you have them, and make this completely open-ended. The Supreme Court was asked to rule on this, and they took a pass.
Right.
Where are we now with this, with the questions raised by that case?
Perfectly honest. Well, I mean, as you point out, I mean, the things that we know about Jose Padilla are that he arrived in O'Hare Airport, like millions of other people, in civilian clothes and without any arms. Publicly, that we know that he changed his religion, which is a constitutional right of people, to Islam, and that he traveled to Islamic countries. That's what we know about this. As you were suggesting, he was arrested, declared an enemy combatant, a citizen, you know, the president's making war on a citizen in this war on terror, and then Attorney General Ashcroft went on television and said, Padilla is in a plot for a dirty bomb attack on a major American city. That's what he said on television. Padilla was never had a chance to even hear this. He didn't have a chance to defend himself before a military tribunal, let alone a Bill of Rights tribunal. He just sat there without a lawyer for 2 years, and for 3 years, and then finally when the case came before the Supreme Court, just as it was about to come before the Supreme Court, the government finally took him out of military prison and put him in and charged him with an unrelated crime. The government has been backing away from this dirty bomb stuff within months of Attorney General Ashcroft's assertions. Unrelated crime, and a much less important one. And the Supreme Court only had three votes to take this case. This was the perfect time to say the President of the United States cannot make war on its fellow citizens so far as the war on terror is concerned. Different case. The people keep on citing what Abraham Lincoln did, what Franklin Delano Roosevelt did. These were not only classic wars, but they were wars in which the future of our independent nation was at stake. That's not true here. The only people who will destroy our Constitution is us, not Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda can destroy tens of thousands of people. But when Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, he said, I'm doing it lest the government go to pieces. If he wanted to reduce the number of people who were killed, he should have let the South go. He was suspending habeas corpus so as to preserve the Union. So this week, only three justices of the Supreme Court voted to take this case, and you need four. This was the perfect time to take this case. We have sort of recovered from September 11th somewhat. If the Supreme Court had issued a decision saying this is the war on terrorism is not like the Second World War, President cannot just, you know, if Padilla is a serious crime to be in a plot to destroy an American city, prove it. And court, just like we've done for the last 200 years, I'm all for that. The Supreme Court didn't do that. It has let stand a Court of Appeals decision which authorized the president to do this. So this is going to really be bad the next time around, you see. If the Supreme Court didn't have enough guts to put the president in his place at a relatively propitious time, what's going to happen if the president rounds up 10,000 people the next time, and the case gets to it 8 months after the attack, will it be five votes to stand up to the president? This is why we need an emergency constitution. That would be a, you know, if we had, if we say, okay, and my, this is my proposal, during a state of emergency, the executive security services can detain people for 45 days on reasonable suspicion, which is a lower standard than the normal criminal law. Then it has to hand over the people to the criminal justice system, because right after an attack, security services won't know what hit them. They'll be very disorganized. It's important to move rapidly and get people who are under reasonable suspicion, detain them for a while to stop the second attack. I'm in favor of it. But it's subject to this supermajoritarian escalator. And there could be no doubt that, that within a year of September 11th, the president would have had a tough time getting 80% majorities in both houses. And in 2 years, for sure, Padilla would have been into the criminal justice system.
So
even if Congress, which I would hope not, they wouldn't do, disagreed with me and said, you can hold people for as long as the emergency lasts. That's not my rule. My rule is you can have a state of emergency for quite a long time, depending on how serious the situation is. But that you only can hold any individual for 45 days. But supposing they said, forget about it, Bruce, we'll just let you hold them for the whole emergency period, Padilla would have been given due process a long time before the Supreme Court finally scared the president into handing him over.
Hmm.
This is a very, very tragic moment. It's a non-decision, but a very serious one, and it's too bad that Justice O'Connor wasn't still on the court, because she would have been the fourth vote.
Yeah, so apparently some of the justices would have been in favor of hearing this case.
Absolutely. Three were Breyer, Souter, and Ginsburg. Then Kennedy, Stevens, and the new Chief Justice Roberts wrote a separate opinion, saying, well, it's hypothetical because the government has handed them over, but we might do it some other time. And then three, the new Judge Alito, Scalia, and Thomas simply refused to hear the case.
So then essentially those justices who voted not to hear the case, essentially what they were saying was, well, because the government has reclassified him now, put him
right
into the criminal justice system, the question is moot. There's nothing to rule on. It sounds as if you're saying that what you really feel is that those three and the others that didn't vote one way or another were simply taking a convenient route out of dealing with a very difficult and very sensitive political matter.
Well, the Justice Kennedy... his opinion that for himself, Stevens and Justice Roberts did not say the case was moot. You see, because the government said expressly that if Padilla is acquitted in this criminal trial, we retain the right to call him an enemy combatant again.
Mm-hmm.
So six judges, as I said, Scalia, Alito, and Thomas, just said, forget it. But six judges agreed that it was not moot, but three of them said it was imprudent to go forward right now. Well, that was a tragic mistake. This was the perfect time. It'll be much tougher to protect these. You know, I can't emphasize the last time in the Anglo-American tradition a citizen was held for 3 years without being told charges against him was before 1680. And Parliament enacted the Habeas Corpus Act to prevent this. This is not some kind of frill. This is really a terror. And this is the classic use of the writ of habeas corpus. And for the Supreme Court at the end of 3 years, in a case that was not moot, because the government says we're going to hold, we might, if we lose in the criminal case, we might grab him again, and said explicitly to say it's imprudent to act in a way that will preserve Padilla's rights and reassure the rest of Americans that the last 350 years of Anglo-American jurisprudence isn't going down the drain. This was a serious and tragic moment.
We're down to the point here. We have a minute or so left. I guess that it one perhaps the last thing I could ask was, how likely do you think that it is that some of the kind of changes that you're suggesting we make in an effort to better be prepared to do what we need to do, to want to respond to the threat, to try to preserve civil liberties, to try to preserve the
functioning
government, it's going to happen.
Right. If the Supreme Court had acted in Padilla in the right way, it would have increased the chances.
Yeah.
If the Democrats win one branch of the Congress next time, this is a much more constructive way of proceeding than all this talk about censure and impeachment. What we want to do is to have some kind of practical solution, forward-looking solution to real problems, rather than engage, as it happened in the Clinton years, on this, you know, terribly time-consuming and diversionary thing of trying to impeach a president in the last period of his presidency. So I would think that maybe the time might come for a really serious consideration. It happened in the 1970s after Watergate. There was an emergency act passed. We've learned a lot about its technical weaknesses, and that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to cure these technical weaknesses and actually recreate the separation of powers for the 21st century here.
Well, we will have to stop there with the recommendation that if people want to read on the subject, you can look for this book that we've talked about. It's titled Before the Next Attack, Preserving Civil Liberties in an Age of Terrorism. It is published by the Yale University Press by our guest, Bruce Ackerman. He is Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale. Professor Ackerman, thank you very much.
Pleasure talking to you.
The broadcast today made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. The staff at Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and new seasonal dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week. We are going to take a break as we usually do this time. We'll have news at 1 minute past the hour. Before that, an update on the commodity market, so please stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety.